Welcome everyone to this week's podcast of ideas. My name's Adam Rawcliffe. I'm partnership manager here at the Institute of Ideas. Today we'll be discussing the UK election and the ongoing election in France. So as you should be aware by now, there's been a snap election called for the 8th of June. Unofficially, campaigning has begun, but Parliament is set to dissolve next week when campaigning will begin in earnest. So Theresa May claims that the election will give her a stronger mandate to negotiate and then see through Brexit, whilst also getting the best deal for Britain. And some supporters of Labour, and more prominently the Liberal Democrats, are running on the slogan that they hope to stop Brexit from happening. Whilst the election call was just about a shock to everyone, many have claimed that May's move is undemocratic and an attempt to destroy all opposition parties and leading us to a one-party Tory state. But then other people have claimed that the Brexit scenario means that this election is a bit different, focusing more on the Brexit issue and other issues more broadly, and not focusing along old party political allegiances. There are claims that people in the North and others in Scotland will turn Tory for the first time ever, and that the Labour Party may crumble. Across all lines, it seems this is a very different election to even 2015 or many that we've had before. Whilst in the UK we're gearing up to our election, France is in the second round of its election. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen are the two survivors. And most notably, the two dominant parties up until this point have been dissolved and don't have a stake in their second round. So the EU watches on with bated breath, with a discussion that France may be facing a Frexit if Le Pen wins, but it seems more and more likely that the centrist Emmanuel Macron will become the new president. So to discuss all this and more, I'm joined both by the team here at the Institute of Ideas, our director, Claire Fox, our Director of Membership and Events, Jeff Kidder, and the newest member of the team, our Associate Director, Alistair Donald. So to kick us off, Claire, why don't you start? Why has May called this election, and what should we expect from the coming month of campaigning?
Well, I think that I don't know other than what she said in terms of why she called the election, but actually I found her reasons reasonably convincing, which was that the problems that she was facing internally amongst the political parties within her own party, even in the House of Lords, the unelected House of Lords, as she said, which was an extraordinary thing for a Conservative Prime Minister to stress, were trying to thwart what she considered to be the seeing through of the referendum result in relation to leaving the EU. And so she is calling it for a mandate. Now, there's been all sorts of cynical comments in relation to that. I think it was telling and unsavoury that so many people, when she called the election, immediately reacted by saying, oh no, we don't need an election. This is the last thing we need, because it had a kind of real anti-democratic spirit and was particularly, it seemed in bad faith, especially from people who'd been constantly stressing that she was an unelected Prime Minister. So, you know, that seemed very peculiar. What can we expect from the election? I think that it's quite interesting when you hear politicians trying to address, as it were, just issues outside of the prism of Brexit. When they, you know, you could say perfectly legitimately, the Labour Party says, let's talk about our proposals on education. I mean, some of the education proposals are a bit wacky, mad. I mean, mad in the sense of, you know, an unrealistic wish list that bears no relationship to the real world. But that, it wasn't so much that, it was just you suddenly thought, yeah, but why are you talking about that when actually the key issue is Brexit? And I suppose I don't want normal politics to be suspended. I mean, in as much as I want to be able to hold politicians to account across the board on across a series of policies. But I think that the electorate understands, and certainly some parts of the Conservative Party understand, and some parts of the Liberal Party who, for different reasons, understand that what's really at stake here is not a rerun of the referendum, but a kind of where we stand in relation to the EU referendum, and that actually all of the policy decisions that will emerge knowing that Britain is leaving the EU, and therefore it's what visions of Britain we might get. Just to also note that as soon as Theresa May and the Tories start talking about policies outside of the context of Brexit, they sound like the dull, technocratic, lacking in vision politicians they really are. The only thing that gives them a kind of added spurt is when they kind of put it in the context of a new vision for... So
yeah, a lot on the table there. Let's go to the Brexit question first then. So, are May's claims true? Will the election be beneficial to Brexit negotiations and getting the best deal for Britain? The Conservatives already had a term up until 2020. They're only adding on 2 extra years if they win this election. But also importantly, are the Tories the only hope for a good Brexit? Alistair, maybe you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been very interesting the way that this has been presented. I mean, just listening actually to Theresa May speak yesterday, where she was talking in Wales, visiting some workplace or other, I can't remember which one, where she very much presented it as, you need to vote for me so that you strengthen my hand in the negotiations. And it was almost like she was saying, well, elect me because you need to trust me to do the right thing in terms of negotiating Brexit. And you just think, well, actually, the thing is that we all need, as a democratic society, to be involved in the discussion on Brexit. It's not like we hand over the mandate for her just to do what she wants, because as we all know, she was a Remain campaigner. The majority of the Tory party were Remain campaigners, and you don't ever get the feeling that they particularly want to be in this situation. It's just that they've recognised the way that the wind is blowing, and they've set themselves up in order to avoid the sort of problems that the Labour Party are having, where they've seemingly have very little policy on Brexit, other than you suspect that they kind of don't really want it. She's seen the way the wind is blowing and have bent their policies towards that, and given across the sense to everyone that this is the way that we need to go. But to hand over her just the mandate to go away into a closed room in Brussels and negotiate a deal, I think, is the wrong way of looking at it. I think this election is very much all about all of us being involved and keeping on the pressure. And in that sense, the policy discussion is framed by the Brexit discussions, I think, very much. You can't have a policy discussion in absence of a recognition of Brexit as a democratic mandate and what that actually means in terms of the way that the policies are framed.
Okay. Well, firstly, in terms of the election is important for democracy because the last election was in 2015. Since then, we've had a referendum, we've had Cameron resigning, all sorts of things have happened in the UK, major events. And so to seek a mandate and to have an election, it's a sign of the health of democracy that's happening. So that's important. I was listening to a debate yesterday on the BBC where it was being argued that if Theresa May, I have no idea this will happen, if she gets a big majority or if any party gets a big majority, then that's no longer democratic because the other parties aren't able to form an effective opposition. And it's an elected dictatorship as it was presented. Which is an outrageous argument, because the point is, even if every seat is won by one party in a democracy with a fair system, as we will have in this election, then that is the result of democracy, whether you like it or not. So there are a lot of very insidious arguments being brought in to undermine this election, which at the end of the day is a standard general election. Similar to many called in the past by existing parties. My personal view on the broader things, Adam's saying start with Brexit in relation to the election, but it is an all-encompassing issue which sort of covers the election in many ways and all aspects of it. To me, the political landscape in Britain, in terms of the parties and what they represent, may well be very different on June the 9th. Adam mentioned that the Conservatives may do well in areas where traditionally people would not consider voting for them, in some traditional working class communities. It's quite possible in other more affluent areas, leafy areas around London, people who voted Conservative all their life will now not vote Conservative because of they have a different view on Brexit. So I don't think we can, even though the polls are pointing to Theresa May having a big majority, I don't think we can take that for granted, because there's a lot to happen and a lot, you know, the parties are in some ways vessels into which this broader discussion is taking place, and where the coins drop, you know, where the land lies on the June the 9th, I think it's too early to be sure on that.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, I think worth digging out a bit more. So interestingly, at the last election, the SNP won almost every seat in Scotland. No one claimed that an elected dictatorship, but the prospect of the Tories completely changes the conversation. But yeah, Claire, do you agree that this election kind of transcends the old party lines and a bit more broadly across the Western world? We saw what happened in France with the old political parties. In America, there's questions whether the Republicans and Democrats are still at the right lines to still go down. What do you think about that? Do you think there's more faith in democracy in this election because we're actually thinking about the content rather than voting for our favourite team, maybe?
Well, I think that the difficulty has been that the meanings of left and right, and even centre-left and centre-right and social democracy and so on, have long since been labels with little content, because political parties and politics has been emptied out of ideology and principle and replaced by, you know, you can't change it, there is no alternative, technocracy, you know, we can only tinker. So it means that the relationships of the political parties, whether left or right, to their kind of core constituencies historically, had become more shallow. So I stress that because I don't think it's per se democratic that people will swap what party they vote for, because there was a real genuine commitment. It meant something to vote Labour in the past. It meant something to vote Conservative. It even meant something to vote Lib Dem or SNP. So the fact that that has become meaningless is the end of a process where the political parties have become, you know, vessels of an elite that are kind of been scrambling around at the top. Now what's happened is that the people, as it were, have entered the stage and given the established parties a bloody nose and effectively said, these empty vessels no longer represent us. We want a new kind of politics. So I don't want to rehearse all of this, but it's the fact that the French presidential elections have two people standing, one who isn't even in a party or representing a party, Macron, and Marine Le Pen, who in order to stand, by the way, has resigned from her party. I mean, extraordinary. But I mean, not the main two parties are now in the runoff, says that there's a broader theme here. In terms of, though, in the UK election sense, I think it's very interesting to see people who have all their life, as Jeff indicated, voted one way, changing their minds, because they're not doing it in a glib way. So all of the media have discovered this group of people who they've never met before. They're called British people, and, you know, lots of ordinary people, working class people. They've gone to the valleys of Wales, to North Wales, from where I'm from, and they've interviewed these people who say, my family have never voted anything but Labour, ever, 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 and it turns my stomach to say it, but I'm thinking of voting Conservative. Some people are saying, I'm definitely voting Conservative, because... And so I think that there's a misunderstanding within Labour circles that what's going to happen to Corbyn is it's going to be that Corbyn is the problem for the Labour Party. But the problem for the Labour Party in this election is that there is a party that does not represent the core constituency of its membership, of its traditional voters who voted Brexit, whilst the MPs are largely Remain, and Corbyn is trying to hold together these different wings and can't do it so well. So I'm optimistic about the democratic spirit in which people think, I'm going to vote in this instance for what was the one democratic blow that I gave the establishment recently, where we said that Brexit should happen. I also, though, just want to say something, because there is this horrible danger that the millions, and there are millions of people who voted Remain, are caricature of people on the other side, who they're all like Lib Dems who can't cope with the Brexit result. Millions of people who voted Remain are now satisfied that Brexit is going to happen and prepared to make a go of it. It's a much smaller, although influential and substantial minority who will choose to vote for the Progressive Alliance, so-called, anyone but the Brexit Party, Lib Dems, Greens and so on. But most Remain voters are not Remainers in the kind of way that that is expressed. So I get nervous about it being like the nation split between Brexit Remain, but the nation is split about how we deal with Brexit now.
So yeah, so where this question of political parties collapsing in the context of the UK election comes from is mostly the Labour Party. Since this conversation has been going on for a while, really since Corbyn got elected, and in that space of time, the guy's won two leadership elections. He looks good on a soapbox when you hear him in the media. Is there a chance that we're underestimating the Corbyn factor and that Labour might bounce back a little bit?
Well, I mean, I suppose the percentages of who's going to vote for who bounce around from day to day, and I think that's one of the things. I mean, even just to date, Tories down 4%, Labour up 3%. So things are going to bounce around over the next 6 weeks or so. And I think the way to probably better understand it is the longer term trends of what's going on. So. The Labour Party really fundamentally changed in the early 1990s. They were no longer the historic party that they were, the party of the working class. As soon as Smith and then Blair came in and the party changed, they effectively became a party without the same sort of constituency and base as there's been for the majority of the 20th century. So the party is floating around really and trying to, in a way, capture a vote, but it's not in the way it did for the majority of the 20th century. So I think these, I mean, in that sort of type of floating environment, then things can come and go. But the core problem that Corbyn faces is that he's trying to straddle two camps in a sense. On the one hand, he's because of Brexit. On the one hand, he's trying to retain the allegiance of the majority of people outside of the metropolitan centres, who have to a large extent decided that Brexit is the way to go, and there's old working class constituency. So he's finding it difficult to hold on to them because he cannot show commitment to Brexit, while at the same time he's trying to also satisfy the new Labour Party supporting middle classes, if you like, the kind of cultural workers of London and various other different centres who are sold on staying. So he's straddling those two camps is an enormous problem for them, and it looks to me like he cannot satisfy both of those camps, and that's why the Labour Party is really going to struggle to convince during this election.
I don't know. He's in a very difficult position because he's trying not to alienate either group. As Alistair said, and the thing about the Labour Party is that many years ago it represented the trade union leadership, sections of the working class, had a real constituency, as it's been described. Then that ended, and Tony Blair, and it became almost an empty, not quite an empty vessel, but an emptying out vessel. Tony Blair had his project, centrist project. Those people took over the Labour Party, ran it. That became exhausted and discredited. And now the sort of the remnants of who was left have taken over. So the idea that there's this other major group or other sections who could run the Labour Party or do it differently, it's not really like that. I mean, there are small cliques here and there all over the place who think they could run it. But it's the Labour Party is not going to be the party that it was many years ago. It's an empty, you know, it's an empty vessel compared to that, and it's run by Corbyn, who's trying to do what he does. Yes, he's not a great charismatic leader, but he's, you know, trying to make the best of it in a difficult circumstance. But their real problem is that they're, because of the way the vote went last year, and because of that's an overriding issue of the election, that they're trying to talk about poverty, NHS, all these things, which are issues people are interested in. But all political issues now work within the broader context, and you can't take things out of it. And that's the problem that he's got. I don't know, you know, the formal Progressive Alliance, Tony Blair's saying, let's get everybody to vote this way. People aren't like that. They're not putty. You know, people have voted for the parties for generations. Parties have existed against each other for generations. But, you know, the way people vote in this election will no doubt be more tactical than it has been previously. No doubt, this is Britain, that will happen more in an informal way than a formal way. But those things will happen, and that will have an effect on what happens to Labour, Liberals, Conservatives, you know, the whole thing at the end. And how that plays out, and by recent historic standards, everybody calls it a snap general election, it's actually a relatively long campaign, you know, another 6 to 7 weeks to go. And so how that will have worked out by the end, I think it's too early to say.
I think it was very interesting, the reports the other day of the Labour pollsters going in to speak to the parliamentary party about how Labour's perceived throughout the country. And the, by all accounts, the report that they gave to the MPs was that the type of ways and things that Labour want to speak about, so social justice and inequality and fairness, the report from the pollsters was that you just cannot connect that way, speaking about those things, with the vast majority of people that you're trying to appeal to. So there's a kind of, a sort of language difficulty in the way that they're trying to connect. But ultimately, I think that also masks that they haven't really got the politics to be able to appeal to people as well. Because if you think about something like inequality, I mean, what happens when Labour try to talk about inequality and try to do something about inequality? Basically, they commission some research from a think tank or an academic department, which broadly speaking is commissioned because it's advocacy research and they know what they're going to get, which then means that inequality, instead of being something that is reflective of, for example, low wages or poor jobs that the vast majority of people suffer from, they talk about inequality in terms of behaviour of people, that they're going to live, that their life expectancy is lower because they, you know, don't exercise enough or they drink too much or eat the wrong food or all the rest of it. So these things are instinctively, I think, things that people have actually become a bit tired of being prodded to do the right things. So that kind of attempt to appeal on issues like inequality is fundamentally opposed to what people actually are after, which is, you know, better jobs and better wages, which actually is not resolvable through inequality policies in and of itself, because what actually needed is not wage caps or salary caps or whatever else the Labour Party want to talk about just now, but actually economic transformation. Mm-hmm. It's growth. And the growth versus equality debate is fundamentally problematic for them, because as long as you focus on equality, which is a kind of levelling down or just sharing out the cake a bit more, you actually miss what is the much more important thing about growth of economy and introduction of better jobs.
Okay, so something that's been mentioned a couple of times is this idea of a potential Progressive Alliance. So do you think, and also tactical voting, do you think there's any hope for a Progressive Alliance, or that tactical voting can ever work? But also, interestingly, I heard a point that the impetus of this election lies with the Remainers. It's them who are going to go out, campaign, mobilise, and eventually go to the ballot box when we go to vote on June the 8th. So are the Tories perhaps being a bit overconfident? All those who are mobilised to vote Brexit necessarily turn up for this election? Could the Remainers sort of have the impetus to make change?
I think that the Progressive Alliance has some impetus behind it, and there are undoubtedly people who are so committed to... I mean, I don't... just to be clear, I mean, nobody is saying let's stop Brexit explicitly. I think somebody said that they were, but I don't think they are. They're disingenuously saying let's stop hard Brexit, let's soften Brexit, let's hold rein in Brexit. They actually mean let's stop Brexit, but I'm just saying. Yeah. And that's the kind of code. And I think that there's a really kind of dynamic a group of people who are going to be out canvassing on that. That will get some votes in. I'm not always opposed to tactical voting, and I might be doing a bit of tactical voting myself in this election. I've already explained that the political parties don't have the same meaning anymore. Yeah. I don't think that that the old allegiances count. I think the left-right divide even becomes more confusing than enlightening. Certainly when I was campaigning for Brexit, most of the people who were lined up against me were Conservatives and the establishment on the right. So, it kind of doesn't help. But one thing that's been one of the most disgusting and unsavoury aspects of this election campaign so far has been the assault on Tim Farron for his attitudes in relation to homosexuality, gay marriage, sin, his religious convictions, his hounding by the media in particular, but by all sorts of sections of the progressive world. And so the irony about the Progressive Alliance, which is actually not progressive, is that it's imbued with all of the most divisive aspects of identity politics, diversity, language, equality that Alistair mentioned, which often just means, how can we introduce equality policies into a workplace? We'll bash the present workers and get them to kind of speak, kind of to cut out their banter and kind of learn how to use a correct pronoun and use the correct language and so on. And suddenly this Progressive Alliance kind of collapses under the weight of an assault on Tim Farron for his homophobia because he's a Christian. And the reason I mention that is because I actually think that bodes badly for the dynamism of the Progressive Alliance, when certainly in terms of social media, the people who've been attacking me for defending Tim Farron for his to be allowed to have views that they don't like, because I believe in religious freedom, the people who've been attacking me have often been, would you believe it, Greens, people who've taken against me because they're in the Remain camp. Remain Labour people. I mean, so you think, well, so much for unity on that front then. So I don't know whether some of that kind of internal infighting might, it's certainly been an unsavoury thing to watch. But you mentioned, Adam, the SNP. I think that's also been interesting because the SNP doesn't know how to get into this Progressive Alliance quite, and is fighting its own battles. And I think if ever there was an indication of how political alliances have changed over the years, it has been the collapse of the Labour Party in Scotland, the absolute collapse of them, and the dominance of the SNP, and now the slight unravelling of the SNP's kind of ubiquitous dominance, giving way to the emergence of the Conservative Party in Scotland, which something that nobody ever foresaw. So I think there's all sorts of ways that the dynamism and the tactical voting happen. It's not kind of being led by the Progressive Alliance. That's clear to me.
Yeah, I think there's a long way to go. I think the Farron thing Claire's described well, and the fact that he's now backed down and done the mea culpa and all the rest of it, may play well. I mean, even in a votes, political thing, it may play well in, parts of inner London or whatever. It would play less well in other places where people are thinking he's being hounded because there's a lot of Christians in the country. Yeah. A lot of other people who will think, what's going on? Why are they so totally obsessed with this? Whatever. That doesn't necessarily play in a straightforward way. I mean, as I said before, I think that the formal party's not standing. It's happening in a few places where the Greens aren't standing or the Liberals aren't standing to let another. There's other places where there's big rows about it as well. I just think, and there's people such as Tony Blair and Gina Miller through various organisations have raised a certain amount of money, and there are websites, but I don't know how much that affects. I just think informally, people in different places will vote around those issues and recognise in the way that people vote tactically in the past. If you want to get rid of a certain party, you vote for a certain candidate. And that, people in terms of what their views are quite sensible and will vote in different ways. The SNP, to me, I don't know what will happen in Scotland, but that when you look at politics now in Britain, it's quite serious. The stakes are high, negotiations with the EU, it's important, trade, what's going to happen with the future of Britain or whatever. and they do come across as not the most serious organisation in the world, and maybe, you know, it often appears that they're presenting something because they think that they have a short-term benefit saying let's do this referendum here, referendum there, and it doesn't necessarily appear as entirely serious. And they don't, you know, are these people serious enough for the times we're living in? That I get that impression that that's how some people view them, but they've got such a lot of support in Scotland, they may well maintain a lot of support in Scotland. I'm not entirely sure how that will play out.
Just quickly on the tactical stuff, I mean, I think there's a little bit of difference between tactical alliances and tactical voting, because with tactical parties, getting together and deciding not to stand in certain places, I think there's a real danger in that. Obviously, democracy to some extent works on the basis of the choices that are available. So not only does it show complete lack of confidence in what the parties stand to, that they're willing to stand aside, but it's actually a denial of the choices that we need, I think, to be able to assess where we want to go in the future. Whereas tactical voting from us, I think, is a completely legitimate thing, because you can decide that if you're so worried about someone being elected, and obviously the thing about a UK election is that you vote for a person with a party in brackets afterwards, which I think is quite an important thing to recognise. Is different. So if you can identify a person that you think you might not agree with the policies of the party that they stand for, but you think that they're going to do a really good job in terms of defending the democratic spirit, which I think is what we absolutely need to do just now, then I think it's entirely legitimate to make that tactical decision and vote for someone that you wouldn't necessarily agree with all of their policies.
Yeah, and of course we shouldn't just blame it all on the Liberals. UKIP themselves have come out and said that they won't stand against good Brexiteers. If anyone cares about that, then that's a different question. So moving on to France. So it looks like Emmanuel Macron will win the French presidency, just pipping Le Pen to it. Macron's an interesting character for me in the fact that by being a centrist, he seems to stand only for things in opposition to what Le Pen stands for, and not much of his own accord. Do you guys think Macron stands for anything? And some people calling him France's JFK, which seems outrageously hyperbolic to me. But yeah, what do you guys make?
Okay, well, I think that, I mean, it's what he stands, what he isn't. I mean, you've got the final round without the two historic, without the left and the right, historically the left and the right, and the Socialist Party and the Republican Party, who are those parties. And he's come in as a kind of, he seems to me, on first viewing, as a kind of lightweight Tony Blair, who's got that kind of idea of being above the parties, taking a bit here and a bit there and doing anything. He hasn't come across in anything I've seen as having a substantial program or having any kind of substantial or any kind of base of support which has got any substance to it. Obviously, a lot of people have voted for him for what he is, and he may win. I mean, even on that, he will probably win the election. That's a probability. But all the commentators saying already it's a done deal after what's happened in the UK last year, in America and elsewhere, I don't think it's necessarily 100% decided, and also the closeness of it. Although, you know, Le Pen is an unpleasant character. I mean, I wouldn't vote for either of them if I was in France and had a vote. But no, he seems like a sort of a centrist, lightweight Blair character. I just keep thinking of the image of Blair going into Downing Street in 1997 with the streets lined with people cheering him and all the rest of it. And then a few years later, he's totally discredited. Yeah. And you feel that this is a lightweight version, and that whole process will probably happen a lot quicker, which is why there's already this fear of Macron 27, Le Pen 2022, as they're saying. Not that that's necessarily going to happen, but that's already being talked about because people don't see him as somebody who's will be a competent and credible president.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned UKIP at the end of the last segment, and it's just worth noting in relation to the France discussion that, you know, one of the things that's been extraordinary to behold has been the implosion of UKIP, who basically I'm delighted to see, because it kind of gives the lie that UKIP delivered the referendum, that UKIP were the main drivers of the referendum, that Farage were the hero of the referendum. UKIP played a part in gaining the referendum, but they were a small part and they have no substantial base beyond that. So I say that because I think that Marine Le Pen's Front National has a much longer history in France and greater roots, even though it's made up of a ragbag of all sorts of everyone from kind of royalists who regret the French Revolution ever happened, you know, through to kind of Catholics and, you know, all sorts of disappointed Communist Party members, and there's a whole different group there of people. But I stress that because although here we discuss them, and in France, in fact, they're discussed as a kind of fascist party, I think that's overstating it. They are definitely dark forces, and there's definitely their kind of anti-liberal attitude to Muslims, sort of sinister history, is not to be underestimated. But I just do not think they're fascism on the rise. So I say that because I think that Macron is a kind of new kid on the block and represents something of the new politics, because everything is about, I mean, he's kind of like the kind of slick Tony Blair-like Trump, you know. He kind of came out of the mainstream parties and kind of is just, and everyone's going, who's he? What happened there, right? But he's not like Trump in as much as he's actually part of that establishment. The fact that, you know, he's the kind of darling of Polly Toynbee in The Guardian in the UK, came over here and says we can learn something from him, I think is misguided, but I think he'll probably win, but I don't know. Just the one thing that we were talking about, some of us earlier, not when we were recording, was when he went into a factory in his hometown yesterday. He went into the factory. This is his hometown where, you know, if you want, you're at least meant to kind of go in and get a few people patting you on the back. And there was almost a riot. Basically, the workers screaming at him and shouting at him. He had absolutely nothing to say to them, no relationship with them. He was humiliated. And you just thought, he represents the problem of contemporary politics. Le Pen does not represent the solution or the answer, but she will definitely gain from the fact that he doesn't know how to deal with the millions of ordinary people in France and doesn't even understand their concerns, and undoubtedly secretly thinks they're all deplorables.
Yeah, so I think one of the things which is to be admired about Le Pen is that she does connect with everyday people. Because of this, she's been labelled with the dirty word of populism. If she loses, are we going to put to bed this end of the talk of populism as a dirty word, or even populism on the rise throughout Europe, particularly in light of Wilders losing the Dutch election as well? And it seems like the EU has gone through a bit of a shaky period with this attack on the establishment, attack on the elites. Is the EU's shaky period over, or should they still be worried?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's not over. No, the most remarkable thing, I think, on Monday morning was looking at the maps of France and seeing how the votes of the Socialist Party in 2012 compared to last week. And 2012, Hollande's election, lots of colour on the map for the Socialist Party. 2017, they're just nowhere. And you just, it really gave you a sense of how complete the wipeout is of the mainstream parties in France over the last few years. The exhaustion of the way that politics has been done in France for 50 years or so. So I think that was really remarkable, and I think in many ways these trends, I mean, the exhaustion of those politics is very clear to everyone. What's less clear is the way that the new politics are going to develop. I think the fascism thing, the Le Pen fascism thing, was interesting because in a way it hints at the way that Macron's supporters recognise his lack of substance. So the anti-fascism thing, the accusations against Le Pen, have been a slightly desperate in places way of trying to shore up support for the centre in a situation where, as Jeff has said, there's not a lot of substance to those sort of centre-ground politics. But I just think it's interesting the way that things are playing out in different... similar trends are playing out in different ways in different countries. So Macron obviously saw the way the wind was blowing and got out of the Socialist Party and went out on his own, which has seemed to work on a temporary basis for him at least, especially if he gets elected president. But in Britain and Holland, as you've mentioned, things have played out different ways. I think it depends on the longevity of the parties, for example. I think it's been interesting the way that the Tory party in Britain have been able to adapt to a certain extent. The party political and electoral systems, for example, in Holland, where the proportional representation had quite a big influence, I think, on the election, and meant that it's almost certainly going to be coalition forms of government, and so the populists didn't quite make it into government. And France, where it looks like Macron is going to get the vote, get the decision in the end, but French politics are going to continue to change very much so, I think, in over the next few years, and it's just a kind of question of waiting to see how things start to work themselves out.
One very quick point on Le Pen, which is the flip side of what Claire's example of Macron and Le Pen visiting the factory, the Whirlpool factory yesterday, is for me, it's just a depressing thing that it is the case that workers who in the past looked to the left, look to progressive people for a solution to their problem. The only person standing who's got any authority is Marine Le Pen and the National Front, which is the case. But it's a depressing thing. And I'm told people who live in France, in small villages and away from the metropolitan centres, she's seen as the last person standing who people will look to for some authority and will give their political allegiance to. And the fact that that's to the National Front, a party that I would have no time for at all, is a very depressing state of the politics in 2017.
Yeah, just on the broader points about populism, I think that the thing that's interesting is that nobody who's labelled a populist calls themselves a populist. That label has only been given by other people. And it's been used to basically discredit being popular by unpopular elites who seem to think that the way to kind of demonise people is to say, you're a populist, that must mean you're a kind of dark, sinister force. And also, the different ways that this plays out nationally are all lumped together. So you kind of have Brexiteers or the interchangeable with Geert Wilders and his kind of Quran burning, xenophobia, who are then lumped together with people who voted for Trump, who are then lumped together with some people who are not sure about who to vote for in the French presidential election because there's two terrible choices. We've got all this going on. So I think that the difficulty is that from the EU's point of view, and you asked, I think the EU have got very deep problems in relation to the economy, in terms of the fact that actually they've never had a democratic mandate from the constituent that from the masses of people who live in the different nation states that are in the EU, there hasn't always been a kind of happy consensus. But I think that if they continue to try and write off opposition as far right populism as a way of discrediting people, then that will actually backfire on them big style. There's no way that you can carry on condescendingly treating people with contempt, saying they're stupid, they're so gullible that they are marching towards authoritarianism, that all they have to do is to hear somebody speak well and they get influenced by demagoguery, that there's Hitler around every corner. The Pope's at it, talking about Hitler and 1930s and populism. This is the establishment unable to understand why they've just got a bloody nose in so many places. then, in trying to understand it, recreating the very conditions that led them to getting the bloody nose in the first place. And so in that sense, I don't think the populist problem has gone away. And just, I suppose, finally from me, I think that populism today is something we should be excited about, in the sense that the people have re-emerged on the stage of history. That change is now not, you know, something you read about, but something you can do. It doesn't mean that a kind of populist uprising, as such as we've seen and are seeing, leads to necessarily positive outcomes. But the precondition for things changing positively is that people believe that change is possible at all and that they can play a part in it. And in that sense, populism is a kind of stirring of people sort of saying, I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to be done to. I can possibly do. And so in that sense, I want to be very positive about its potential.
I think what is apparent there is that there's a lot at stake across the Western world. And no doubt things will emerge, unravel and change before we go to the ballot box on the 8th of June. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Podcast of Ideas. If you like what you've heard, you can find more episodes in our back catalogue on instituteofideas.com/podcast. And you can also find the Podcast of Ideas on iTunes.